Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity segment on the Total Education Network. And GJ, always excited to introduce our guest. And it's very interesting, former career of mine. So I'm excited to interview. We've only had one other wrestler on, but this guy's an amazing wrestler and looking forward to learn more about him.
Well, I think you should, it's more appropriate for you to introduce him because you are a professional wrestler and I can barely spell wrestling.
Well, I'm going to introduce him in a way of the thought process of understanding that he is one of the newest, hottest, up-and-coming stars. He is a star already in pro wrestling, but I see him as continue to grow all the way to be considered one of the best of all time with all his different championships. And he's with TNA right now, and he's a very, very successful wrestler. And we want to learn more about specifically how he became who he is today. So I'm going to welcome to the program Christopher Daniels. Christopher, how are you?
I'm doing great, and just to answer DJ, it's WRESTLING, so we got that out of the way. I wanted to help him spell that, so that's cool. And everything's going great, man. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I mean, for our listeners out there that are entrepreneurs and also into the specific celebrity part of this, because, again, I'm going to say you definitely are a celebrity. You have a huge Twitter following, and you are becoming the wrestler. And it's very interesting, the stomping grounds, to talk about some of the feuds you had with people. I helped train Chris Harris. I worked with Shark Boy over at Les's Fed and have been around. And a lot of the guys that have come through TNA were in the minor leagues back in the day. So it's very interesting to see how far TNA's gone to be one of the large feds and competing with the other fed. I won't bring up the name. But first of all, tell Christopher how you broke into the professional wrestling business. It's not like you go and get your big shot. You have to pay your dues.
First of all, I grew up in North Carolina, which is a hotbed for professional wrestling back in the 80s. I watched the Mid-Atlantic Territories, which ended up becoming the NWA, which then ended up becoming World Championship Wrestling. So I grew up watching guys like Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes and the Road Warriors. After I graduated college, I moved to Chicago, and I was doing theater, which is what my degree was in, and I happened to find a wrestling school, and during a dry spot in my acting career, I decided to give it a try. Just to say to my kids, you know, if I failed and never had a chance or never did anything with it, at least I could tell them I gave it a shot. But once I started training, because I was a fan, I felt like I had a frame of reference. It was very, my training in terms of learning how to do stuff went very quickly. And it wasn't too long after I started training that I started wrestling matches. And as you know, that's where you learn most of your stuff is when you're wrestling in front of live crowds. And that was 20 years ago. So here we are today. I've been very fortunate to wrestle for both TNA and Ring of Honor, another great company based out of the Northeast. And like I said, I've been very fortunate. And it wasn't an overnight success. It wasn't like I started wrestling and then the next day. No. I was on national television. It took me a while.
I felt the same thing. I ended up going overseas to Germany and wrestling and had the opportunities with the Fed, but just things didn't work out in my career. And then I ended up becoming a teacher. It's kind of a funny story, Christopher. But I think what GJ, as we've talked about and part of the business part of the show, is that you don't get to the big time first, G, at the start. It takes time, you know, G?
Well, sure. And one of the things I was just thinking of is Christopher's a 20-year overnight success. And I was thinking that, you know, as an entrepreneur, you know, a lot of people say, well, how'd you get your success? And I said, well, it took 20 years of ups and downs. So it's a 20-year overnight success. So obviously, you know, you've had that success. And when you've, you know, obviously, if you stay the course, and that's another thing that I teach, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs that I work with is staying the course. So you've been able to stay the course. So how were you able to stay the course, knowing that, you know, with the ups and downs? And obviously, I know it's such a physical sport. And as I've learned is that you cannot fake gravity. So how were you able to stay the course with, you know, the ups and downs, the traveling, you know, and just the sheer physical, you know, ability of the, you know, the stress on your body. How have you been able to stay the course?
Well, wow, that's a pretty complicated question. So, I mean, it's not like a one-word answer. Well, first of all, one of the first things I learned, or like one of the lessons I learned in the first couple of years of wrestling, was that talent was going to rise to the top. So I concentrated on honing my craft and getting better and getting to the point where I could meet a person, one, you know, meet someone in the afternoon and wrestle them and have a great match with them that night. And once I became comfortable enough where I could do that with anybody, you become a commodity to promoters. You know, I didn't get my break until I moved out to California, and I started networking, and I got a chance to go overseas and some other things. And all of these things sort of happened where, like, promoters, by word of mouth, heard that I was, you know, good hands, so to speak. They found out that I was, you know, worth bringing out, and if they brought me out and they put me in the ring with one of their best guys, they would have a match that was worth tickets. Like, it was worth it for the fans to pay tickets to pay to see me wrestle. And so, you know, that was one thing. As far as the physical part of it, you know, when you become a professional wrestler, you learn that you are the product, and so you figure out ways to prolong and you know, keep yourself healthy. Try to avoid injury. Over the last like 6-7 years, I've been very focused on trying to stay as healthy as I can in terms of my physical fitness. I do things like yoga and a lot more stretching, a lot more full body workouts, things that are designed to minimize injury and you know, keep it to the point where I can wrestle 4 or 5 nights a week if I have to.
GJ has complicated questions, but they're very good, and that was great. It was great points you've made so far, Christopher. And I'm going to go jump from one thing to the other. I want to get to the brand part, but I want to, first of all, the big break. I like the idea what you said about networking. I didn't get known as a wrestler in the independents to be considered one that would get money and make money in wrestling till I went and decided to go down south and work for Burt Prentice's Federation and Jerry the King Lawler Fed. So I had to leave Pittsburgh, move to the South where I didn't know anyone as well, and then got to network with all these guys. And then they work every night compared to where you were at, where you couldn't find the ability to get to work every night. So once you got to California, who would you say helped you get your big break, or what Fed was the organization that helped you reach the top so that you were able to work for ROH and then also TNA after that?
Well, that sort of happened in 3 different parts. The first one was I got on the the first thing that happened was there was a gentleman named Victor Quiñones who was a liaison to the WWE, or at the time they were the WWF. He was a liaison between the WWE and a lot of foreign talent, but most notably Taka Michinoku, who they brought in to be the first light heavyweight champion around 2001, 2000, or no, excuse me, earlier than that, like 1998, 99. I knew him through a friend of mine in Puerto Rico, and he was a big promoter in Puerto Rico, but because he knew so much Japanese and Mexican talent, the WWE tasked him to be sort of the guy that brought in all of this foreign talent to the WWE light heavyweight division. So he knew me, and he got me an opportunity to wrestle Taka Michinoku on one of their syndicated shows, Shotgun Saturday Night. Now, because of that particular match, once it got on television, I got seen by people like Jim Cornette, and Jim Cornette got me into the WWE dojo system, which was where guys like Kurt Angle, guys like Edge and Christian, guys like Val Venus, they came up through that. And because of that, I got noticed by East Coast promoters, guys like Jim Kettner, who ran a company for close to 40 years called the ECWA. And I got a chance to work shows for him, and specifically the Super 8 tournament, which was one of the biggest independent tournaments on the scene. And so once I got embroiled with the ECWA, I got very heavy into the Northeast independent scene, which is where independent wrestling sort of thrives is the Northeast. You know, the area from Virginia up through Massachusetts, like all through that area, Philadelphia, New York, New Jersey, that's where independent wrestling thrives here in the United States. Also, having wrestled Takuma Shinoku, I got a chance to meet Japanese promoters and work for Japanese companies. First of all, Shinoku Pro, which is a very prestigious independent company, and then through them, New Japan, which is the Japanese equivalent of the World Wrestling Federation. So through Wrestling Taka and his networking, as you said, I got a chance to go overseas. And once I went overseas, the hardcore wrestling community sort of took notice of that. And that also helped me get work in the United States because most of the time, a lot of independent promoters are basically fans at heart. And so if they see someone or they hear about someone that's doing something like going over to Japan or someone that's on television for WWE, they think, well, okay, this guy knows what he's doing, and they brought me in to wrestle their local guy. And so that's sort of how all that came around for me. Around 1998, 1999, like all of that period of time, that was sort of my boom period. I was working out here in California for Walt Disney Imagineering, which is the part of Disney that deals with the theme parks, basically just working on the docks. And the company was they're very understanding, accommodating of my schedule. But there was a period of time where I was wrestling like 3 or 4 times a week, and they would let me, you know, continue to keep my job. But I finally got to a point where I was working so often that they had to let me go. It changed from being a hobby or something like one of my many jobs to being my main career right around 1999. I became a full-time wrestler because of my tours to Japan, the stuff I was doing on the East Coast and the Northeast, and the work I was doing with the WWE at that time.
And what's really interesting, Christopher, and I'm going to go right to GJ on this fact, is we talk about so many times with all these superstar celebrities that come on, you got to pay your dues. You got to go through certain things, and it's right place, right time type of situation. When you're talking about acting, well, we interview a lot of Hollywood actors, and the way they end up getting roles, we had a guest on a couple days ago that's now going to be co-starring with Ben Affleck, and literally he was only supposed to get one line, and somebody canceled. So GJ, as I talked about before, it's just right place, right time, and it seems like Christopher got that first break and he just kept sailing through.
Yeah,
go ahead, Christopher.
I was just going to say, wrestling is very much like acting in the sense that it's not necessarily the amount of talent that you have, but the people that you know. It's very subjective. You know, it's not always the best athlete or the best wrestler that gets the spot. In terms of acting, like creative people behind professional wrestling are trying to tell stories, and so they're going to fit in the person that fits their vision best in terms of the characters they want to portray or the characters that they want to put on their television show. So, you know, it's very much like acting in the sense that a lot of times we're auditioning for these parts, and it's not necessarily whether you can jump highest or you can, you know, it's not the strongest guy or the fastest guy. It's, you know, it's basically based on the decisions of your creative team, whether or not you get a job, you know, and then it's a matter of, you know, continually trying to be entertaining to try and keep that job.
MG, I know you have a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, so once you got your break, and obviously it was, a process, once you got that break, and obviously you realized early on that you were a product, and the better product you could put in the ring, the more success you would have, more notoriety. So you became a brand. So once you realized you were the brand, how did that change for you? Because you know, a lot of our listeners have a brand or creating a brand, and you know, what are some tips that you use for yourself to create a better brand and some of the steps that you've done since then?
Well, I mean, like you said, when you realize that you are your product, and me myself, when I realized that I was the product, I understood that I had to put the product ahead of what could have been my own personal, desires. There are many times working in independent wrestling where I don't want to say I was mistreated, but things didn't go right. Like, not all promoters are very professional, and it would have been very easy for me to. Yeah, it would have been very easy for me to, lash out at promoters who were unprofessional to me. But I understood that if I continued to keep a reputation as someone who was professional, sooner or later, that professional promoters would get a hold of me. And as long as I was very cognizant of keeping a good reputation in terms of how promoters dealt with me, I was always very easy to deal with in terms of, flight schedules and what they asked me to do in terms of wrestling in the ring. Like, I was never hard to deal with. I was never a prima donna. I always tried to do what was best for the show, try to do what was best for what that promoter wanted in that evening. And by building a good reputation amongst promoters, they talk that, the word of mouth of being a good hand, like I said before, that went a long way into getting what, basically was repeat business. I would wrestle for a promoter. I would have a good match. And sooner or later, I was wrestling for that particular promoter once a month. And that was, once I built the rapport with the different promoters, slowly but surely, I was building up a schedule where I was working more and more often.
Wow. And then that's the key. And I think that what you saw, and you talked about how important the fans are to you, because again, if you wouldn't have gotten that reputation, the fans who really have changed the business. And Christopher, when I was started, the big men were the big things in wrestling, and that, other types, smaller wrestlers were considered nothing. There were the jobbers in certain aspects. And then the business has changed so much with ECW. And also I'd say even with TNA and WWF, especially when they came up with the light heavyweight division, that wrestling is completely changed, where people who are champions now would never have been champions 25 years ago. So the question I want to ask is, how important are the fans to you in your career, especially with your brand?
Well, I definitely realized that I wouldn't be where I was today if it wasn't for the ardent support of the hardcore wrestling fan base. And I think that's one of the keys to the success of TNA and Ring of Honor. Right around the end of, or right around 2000, 2001, when ECW closed and when WCW closed, all the casual wrestling fans sort of went away. And the thing that remained was that hardcore wrestling fan base, guys that, sought out their professional wrestling, guys that were, on the internet looking for more stuff and trading videotapes of wrestlers from overseas. And I mean, that sort of became the foundation that Ring of Honor and that TNA sort of built their fan base from. And we're always striving to open, sort of widen the spotlight so that more and more people become aware of us. But we never forget the fact that, when we first started, the first people that came and became our fans were that hardcore fan base.
Exactly, and that's the key component. And GJ, and as you see, what any successful brand finds their fan base and increases it, G. Isn't that true?
Right, and we focus it on a daily basis with ourselves. I was on an interview earlier today, and we were talking about that. The brand is a living, breathing organism, and, how do we interact with our fans? How do we get more following? How do we elevate the brand and the course of where we choose to have it go? And Christopher, you've done a great job, and I'm just amazed. I'm just sitting here listening, and I'm enjoying everything you said today, and I've also been educated both how to spell wrestling and about the wrestling and the wrestling industry.
Awesome.
I love your ability to articulate, and one of the things that comes to mind is that the wrestlers that I've interviewed and I've gotten to know, I mean, every one of them, they've realized the business side of things, and they've been able to stay that course, and they're all very, very smart, and a lot of, there's that misnomer, right, where they're big and may not be as smart, and everyone I've interviewed and talked to has been very articulate, and you've done a great job, and it's been an honor to have you on our show. And two things. One is, where can we find more information about you, and so we can get more fans for you and more following, and what else are you doing in you know, working on right now as far as projects and where you're wrestling and how can we help you?
Okay, so many questions in that one question. So many questions, but I'm going to go with all of it. First of all, you can follow me on Twitter at FAC, like Fallen Angel Christopher, FAC Daniels, at FAC Daniels. My website, www.fallenangelchristopherdaniels.com. I try to keep my schedule as updated as possible. When in doubt, you can always go to impactwrestling.com because that's the source for all news about TNA Wrestling. As far as what's coming up for us, the big news is Lockdown, our next pay-per-view. It's March 10th out of the Alamo Dome in San Antonio, Texas. Myself and my partner, the Physical Fascination, Frankie Kazarian, we will be involved. Our tag team is called Bad Influence because we are the bad influence of TNA, not bad meaning bad, but bad meaning good. And we will be involved with Lockdown because we are two of the top stars of the company. And we will be every week. We are on Impact Wrestling on Thursday nights, Spike TV, 8 p.m. Eastern. And we are going to be on the road starting March 14th in Chicago at the Sears Center. We are taping, we're filming our television show Impact on the road from now on starting March 14th. So a lot of big things happening for Impact Wrestling. And, of course, the face of Impact Wrestling, myself, yours truly, Christopher Daniels, at the forefront of it all. I think I covered everything there.
You definitely did, and I guess you're already showing me your goals. Your goals are to continue to see TNA grow and yourself as one of the top stars grow. And, Christopher, definitely stay on the line for a second so we can trade information so we can stay in touch. But very, very cool, and I'm going to have to continue to look back at some of the guys that you've worked with, and we'll definitely stay in touch because, again, I'm the back in the day when wrestling changed. When I was retired in 99, I think that the business definitely made changes, but I think what it's now showing is the people who really are really hard workers. If they get to the right place, right time, the fans really appreciate you, and it's great that you came on the show. So thanks again for calling.
Thanks for having us, guys. I really appreciate it.
All right, take care. All right, you're listening to the Beach Lifestyle Show celebrity segment on Total Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net. For more information, you can email me at HaleyTotalTutor.org or Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. And always enjoy interviewing Olympians, especially I want to welcome the program from the Bahamas, Chris Brown, a gold medalist, and much, much more. Chris, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Not a problem.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you specifically about, first of all, to tell our listeners a little bit about your career, and then some other things you have coming up in the near future, and I guess also the success at the 22 Olympics. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I've been running track for quite some time now, and I've gotten 3 Olympic medals. Been to 4 Olympics, and I've gotten a gold, silver, and a bronze, and won 2 gold medals at the Pan Am Games in 2007, 4 medals at the World Indoor Championships, 3 bronze and a gold. So I've gotten a great accomplishment under my belt.
Well, I think that's it is an accomplishment, and I'm sure you're very, very proud that this happened to you and you were able to accomplish all that.
Yes, I'm very proud of it, and I'm very excited.
Well, I'm sure you are, and let's first of all, specifically, what made you want to become a track star? What were you all growing up your entire life? Did you want to be an Olympian, or did it just come, just happen?
It just happened. You know, I grew up in a family where everybody was, you know, very talented. My brothers ran. I had a mom that ran, aunt that ran, and my dad ran track. And I just took it, you know, just passed on to the generations, and I inherited, and now here I am.
And here you are, and the success that you were able to attain, and I think it really feels good to be representing your country and accomplishing these things, right?
Yes, it sure does, and the benefits are great.
So when you get back, when you go back home, you're treated like a king then, right?
Yes, very much so. everybody knows you, and they hail, and they, you know, they congratulate and thank you for the job that you've done and your service due to the country. So it's a great thing.
Well, that's the important thing, and then I'm sure that you look at it like, as now I'm a role model. I have to make sure I have to live as a role model in my daily life, being a successful Olympian. Isn't that true?
Yes, it is. You know, even the days when you forget that you're a role model and, you know, you want to hang out with your friends and, you know, go places, you got to remember to always, you know, keep a positive frame of mind, and certain places, you know, you can't go or things you can't do, you know. So it's sometimes it's, you know, it's a little tough, but, you know, God don't give you more than you can handle. So I'm blessed and thankful that he blessed me with it.
So I like what you said, that God doesn't give you more than you can handle. So having that success, he knew that you were exactly where you needed to be in your life. And that's great that you look at that. And I think also what's cool is, I guess, you are becoming a promoter in some ways. And I'm sure you're excited about what you're doing with your upcoming event. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I'm very excited. I am putting on a competition, a world-class letter competition in the Bahamas. We got a brand-new facility. It holds 15,000. I'm hoping that, you know, with the success that I have carried on throughout my career, everyone is on board so far to come to the Bahamas and compete. A lot of world-class sprinters are going to be there. They choose the Bahamas to open up their 2012 debut season. So it's going to be interesting, and it's a brand new task for me. I'm stepping in a brand new territory, and it's stressful, it's tiresome, and I got a lot on my plate. So I definitely have to pull it off and still continue to train as well.
Well, I think it's so cool because you go from a track star to deciding to promote, and that's a challenge, right? I'm sure I'm already hearing that in your voice, even though you're really excited about it. It's been a labor of it's been a labor of love since you started, right?
Yes.
And tell me some specifics of just the process of getting something like this large event involved. What are the things that you have to do on a daily basis?
On a daily basis, you have to communicate with the agents to make sure that the athletes are on board. You have to negotiate appearances, prize money. You have to make sure the hotel rooms are secure. You have to make sure there are flights in place for them when they get to travel. You have to make sure that you secure the meals for when the athletes get there. And you also have to lock down a lot of sponsors. You know, sponsors is the main thing. So I am definitely in the market for seeking sponsors and have put this event on. So there's maximum advertisement available for anyone who wants to sponsor the event. But athletes will be coming from all over: Jamaica, United States, Dominican Republic, Haiti, Puerto Rico, and some from out of Europe. So it's going to be a big event, and I'm looking forward to it.
So you're making the phone calls to make sure that the agents make sure that the athletes sign up for this event. You're looking to raise money for prize money and then sponsorship. Now, tell us how you go out there and find sponsors. I guess it's pretty easy if you're picking up the phone, being a gold medalist and very famous in the Bahamas, to go and say, by the way, I'd like you to advertise this event. So how do you go about approaching people for this?
Well, it is that easy when I'm in the Bahamas, but when I have to make phone calls, you know, it can be very tiresome because you got to call back. They are busy, they're in a meeting, but definitely I have a package that I can email to people and let them see the package, what they'll be getting. And once that reaches their desk and they take a look at it, they'll determine whether they want the gold, silver package, or they want to sponsor just an event, or do they just want to be a potential sponsor. So it's different ways of being a sponsor. But it's looking pretty good so far, and there's definitely more room for sponsors. So I'm just hoping that it all comes together well and everybody comes to the Bahamas and have themselves a great time.
Well, I think so, and I think that, again, people that are the athletes, I'm sure they're excited about traveling to the Bahamas as well, right?
yes, they are very excited. They're looking forward to it. It's early in the season, so they get to open up and see where they're at early and make all the adjustments and corrections that they need to make before the season gets underway. It's going to be warm. They're going to enjoy the beach and the lovely people and also eat some good food. So they get a combination of things when they get there.
The combination of things, the different, the beauty of the Bahamas, and I'm sure that the community, once you go out there and are talking it up, they're just excited as can be to have an invitational there, right?
Yes, the community, I mean, the whole of the Bahamas is very excited. Track and field is the number one sport in the country, and you know, hearing a big event come and show up to the doorsteps, everybody was not able to go to the Olympic Games, so just the fact that they are able to see this event live and live in colors right there on their home soil. They are very excited about it, and they can't wait for the event to reach.
What's amazing when you said, Chris, that it's the number one sport in this that country. So it's almost like you're a Super Bowl champion then, right, going home?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, basically, yes. So when a team in America wins the Super Bowl and being celebrated and everybody knows them, that's how it is for us. When we win a medal or when we run track in the Bahamas, everybody knows you and knows who you are and ready to celebrate. So the whole city shuts down. The country shuts down. There's no work being done. so everybody just ready to watch and tune in. So on that night of the event, you know, it's going to be fireworks. Everybody's going to be ready to get in their seats and not miss a moment of it.
Well, I find that so fascinating when you talk about but again, Chris, you got to look at it. You have a gold medal in your hands. That's like you being the wide receiver or quarterback. It's not like you were on the team and they won something or, you know, were part of the Olympic team. You were a champion. And I'm sure that it's very easy for you to go and get sponsorship in the Bahamas for yourself. So now you have to sell the event. So for our listeners out there, and maybe even sponsors listening, what do you think, what's going to make this event such a great event to sponsor? That's the important thing, because, Chris, if you have that elevator speech, you're set to go and you're ready to get all the sponsors and have a very successful event that could be an annual event.
Yes, well, it's definitely going to be an annual event. The event is going to be streamed live on the internet, so they're gonna get maximum exposure throughout the stadium. Like I said, the stadium is going to be seated. 15,000 people are going to be in the stands. Then it's going to be streamed live on the internet. So all of these athletes who got Twitter accounts and Facebook, they're already tweeting about it, and their followers will be following them. So they're going to get maximum exposure to the rest of the world. And you know, it's just going to be something that you would want to help out. You know, it's definitely a new event that's coming. And the governing body, which is the IAAF, they actually come in and do a day in the life of Chris Brown. So it's going to be a great day, and it's going to be it's a great opportunity to become a sponsor.
It seems like it. That's the important thing, to be a sponsor, a great opportunity. And you think you're going to get more sponsorship than just the Bahamas then, with that many people but internet and stuff?
Yes, I'm definitely open and looking forward for international sponsors also, because we have a large tourism group that visit frequently in the Bahamas. We got more than 3 million tourists that visit the country shores every year. So I'm definitely open and looking forward to attracting international sponsors. That makes the event even more exciting. So any type of potential sponsors are very much welcome to be a part of this event.
I'm getting excited myself. So tell us the date when the event will take place.
The event is a one-day event. It's on April the 13th. Some of the juniors will actually be taking part early in the day, around about 2 o'clock, 1:30. Then when the sun goes down, that is when the professionals will come out and perform. So exactly 7 o'clock, all the professionals you will start seeing taking the track. So it's a one-day event, April the 13th, and it's promising to be a great, successful event.
So are you going to be involved in it? You've not retired yet after this year, after the Olympics, have you?
No, I haven't retired yet. After Rio, you know, Rio is going to be my exit out of the game. And I still have a few more years left in the tank. So I got to defend my title. So I'm definitely looking forward to it, and through the grace of the Lord, you know, I'm looking forward to going out with a bang. So I want to be like Super Bowl champs.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, especially individually.
Like
Ray Lewis. Individually, yeah. Individually, you look at it as well. You said, okay, I know you have the gold medal being with a team, but you want to earn that individual gold medal. I'm sure that's what your whole goal is for 2016, isn't it?
Yes, that's the main goal, is to get on the podium individually. I've been at it for a while, and I've been close, and I am praying and hoping that with the blessings of the good Lord that 2016 will be it, and I can walk away with a smile on my face. And even if it don't happen, I can still walk away with a smile on my face, because I have accomplished a lot in the game, and I've gotten a lot of experience, and I'm healthy, and I did it, you know, I did it with the grace of the Lord.
Well, and that's I like hearing that, and I think that's when you have God on your side, how can you lose? That's the key, Chris. So you know you're going to fall sometimes, but you know that you have someone there to always pick you up.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, when you fall, you know, you brush yourself off, because at the end of the day, there's only eight lanes, and only can have eight athletes in the finals, and I'm just happy to always be one of those persons occupying one of those eight lanes. So I'm grateful and I'm thankful for all the success.
All right. Well, Chris, where can we find information on you, learn more about the event, so that if there's sponsorship or people that want to watch the event, and then also learn more about yourself?
You can go to www.BahamasInvitational.com. And it's going to be information there. Or you can also check out my website at chrisbrowntherunner.com. So it's going to be a lot of information there, and also potential spots for you to become a potential sponsor.
And do you have a Twitter account as well?
I'm working on Twitter. I'm definitely working on Twitter. I'm one of the old schools that hasn't reached Twitter yet, but I'm working on Twitter. I'm hoping that by the end of this week, I'll have a Twitter account up and running, so I could you know, be able to interact and speak with the fans, and also to anyone who just want to be in touch with Chris Brown and want to follow my career.
So Siobhan's really good at Twitter, so she's a good friend of yours, so she'll be able to help you out. Just, and myself with pointers, I'll be tweeting you out today. So thanks again for calling, Chris.
Okay.
Look forward to hearing about how everything goes with the event, and have you back after that to tell us the whole story. So thanks again for calling.
All right, thank you, and hopefully maybe one of these days I'd like to see you come to the meet, and I'll give you a good seat.
Oh, I like that. Maybe I'll have to cover it the year after. We'll see how everything goes. You can get some sponsors to get me out there, and I'll cover it. Sounds great.
Okay.
All right, Chris. All right take
definitely.
Care. See ya.
All
okay,
right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
All right,
bye.
You're listening to the Total Education Celebrity Show. We'll be back in just... We're back to the Total Tutor Show and the Total Education Network Celebrity Segment, Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment. I'm really excited to welcome the program NFL 3-time Pro Bowler, 2-time All-Pro selection, Marcus Stroud. Marcus, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm excited to talk to you, and especially about different things. But for our audience, tell us a little bit about your career in the NFL before we get to your foundation.
Well, I was drafted at the University of Georgia in 2001 and went on to play 7 years for the Jacksonville Jaguars and 3 years for the Buffalo Bills. So I had a pretty good run.
Well, it sounds like you had a great run. Anyone that was a Pro Bowler, that's an excellent accomplishment. But it's fantastic how you're giving back to the community. So tell us a little bit about the Marcus Stroud Charitable Foundation. Why did you decide to start it?
Well, the Marcus Stroud Charitable Foundation was something I started a couple of years back, and I wanted to focus on single-parent households and help give those kids a chance to do other things they wouldn't normally get a chance to do. And since then, the foundation has sort of transitioned and started more towards the childhood obesity thing and trying to raise awareness for that.
Fantastic, and I guess it really makes you feel good to see, to be able to help others and give back.
Yeah, it does. You know, anytime you're able to go out there and get a bunch of kids in of life abilities in the same environment, and watch them go out there and have a good time and also learn from it, it's a good feeling.
And what I've noticed from researching your foundation is that you really have a little bit of a different understanding when it talks about how you're going to assist the underprivileged, especially with encouraging wholesome development. Tell us a bit about that.
Definitely. You know, the focus of my foundation is to try to not only help kids get active, but to also help educate the kids and the parents about how effective nutritional ways that you can go and eat and be active and still maintain a healthy lifestyle.
And that's so key because of how much child obesity is out there, correct?
Definitely. Childhood obesity is a increasing problem in the United States, and I want to be part of the problem. I want to be part of the solution and get out there and help these kids.
And that's tremendous. And putting your stamp on things makes things hopefully move more quickly to get those things done, because when you're out in the community telling people about it and showing up at events, kids really pay attention to that, don't they?
Yeah, they definitely do. You know, like I said, man, kids are very, very intelligent. They pay attention to everything, and they know when you're out there genuinely trying to help them and help them do something positive, and they take note of that, and they appreciate it.
And absolutely. So specifically, from when we're talking about your organization and things like that, it's a really a challenge, isn't it, to run your own foundation? It's not the easiest thing in the world, is it? You have to put a lot of time into it, don't you?
I guess it's a lot of time that goes into it. I have a lot of good people on my team who help me, but it's definitely a lot of time. That's a lot of money. That's why we do things to try to do fundraisers to raise money, because I want to go out there and I want to help these kids, but I definitely want to do it at no cost to them.
And that's key. And no cost to them, and being able to run that in a specific way. Do you take some of your success on the football field into the business career of running a foundation and looking at specifically setting the bar high for yourself?
Definitely. You know, I try to go out and overachieve and be the best that I could be off the field, just like I was on the field.
And is this a national organization, or is it more of locally where you've played some of the cities for?
Well, right now it's a local thing, but that's the plan, and that's why I'm trying to expand, because I want to take this program on a national level. My ultimate goal is to try to have this type of camp and obesity training in every NFL city.
That's fantastic. And so basically, kind of to let us our listeners know, specifically before we go into promoting the fundraiser, tell them how the program works. Tell us how the kids are able to go to the camps and stuff like that.
Well, the camp I'm going to have again this year, it's going to be a wellness camp in May. It's the first weekend in May, actually. It's going to be at the Georgia Dome. And the way it is, we have a little registration, and we have pre-registration there before the camp starts. So any kid and their parent who's willing to come and bring them down, we come out for a free day of having fun and learning some things.
And that's great. And so one of the differences between your camp and others is looking at, again, living a healthy lifestyle and the importance of that as well than just learning the sport and stuff, correct?
Definitely. You know, I definitely want to be able to teach kids some of my football skills, but the most important thing is to go out there and get them to be active and healthy and learn about the lifestyle and take something away from the camp where they can go out and do this stuff themselves when we're not around.
So, Marcus, why obesity? What is the reason to fight child obesity? We all know the problems, but is there a specific personal situation that you've dealt through in your life that's made you want to do to pick this as the big push?
Well, no, particularly, no. I just saw a need for it because, you know, once you start off as a kid that's not as active as other kids, that leads to other problems. And I'm trying to stop it in the early stages before you develop the diabetes and the hypertension and the heart problems and stuff like that. We want to try to start it and implement it at an early age where you can take it all throughout your life. I'm just trying to help promote more healthy adults, and I just want to catch them and start from the beginning stage to adulthood.
And that's so key. And you, definitely, that's an important thing to teach them early, so that they don't end up as adults as obese and have diabetes and high blood pressure and also looking at stroke and all those things. If you can prevent those things earlier, you're in a much better situation, that they will tell their kids to eat right. So it's a process of formation at the beginning, starting young. Correct.
Definitely, and if you're able to start young, it's something that could become generational. You don't know who you can affect. It can start early and carry on throughout life, and they can pass it on to their kids. That's how you start good, healthy generational health.
So your big push is Sacking Obesity, and how I know you have a big event coming up. Tell us a little bit about that with Sacking Obesity.
Well, yeah, I have a big event, like I just mentioned, coming up in Atlanta, where we're going to do the fundraising part of the Sacking Obesity Camp. I'm going to have a nice little poker tournament fundraiser. And then the next day, the Saturday morning, we're going to have the Obesity Camp, Obesity and Wellness Camp, that I like to call it, at the Georgia Dome.
Okay, fantastic. So tell us a little about the fundraising part of it. How are any of the other of your former NFL mates coming out to be part of this, and other celebrities and stuff for the raising the fundraiser the night before?
Yes, definitely. I'm going to have Michelle Lau, who's actually a professional poker player. She's going to come out and help me out. I'm going to have Mike Peterson from the Falcons and Deion Grant and Byron Left, which is a couple of my old former teammates, and I'm going to have a couple of new guys there also. So it's going to be a pretty good event.
Well, I like hearing Leftwich because he's a Steeler. So, hey, I don't know if it'll be next year as well, but he was a Steeler. And we always support Steelers definitely on our show. So it sounds great. And I guess the hope is through this fundraiser and then the success of the camp the day after, that you're going to take this model and then take it national, right? You're going to say, okay, look how we were able to do this in Atlanta. Let's try another city.
Definitely, because my aim this year is to have between 500 and 1,000 kids there for free and learning and having a good time. And once people see the success that we're doing and having in Atlanta, it'll be able to catch on and go other places.
And then, so it's all about that, and then contacting all your former players and say, hey, let's try it in this city. What are you doing to fight obesity? Look how we're able to do this and that. So where can my listeners get involved to help donate to your foundation? Where can they find more information about that and get involved?
Well, what they can do is go to the MarcusStrivefoundation.org, go on that page and find out more information and find out the ways of how to either get tickets to attend or find a way to donate or donate your time or anything. That's the way to sign up and find out more information. MarcusStrivefoundation.org.
So your ultimate goal, you said national. Where do you want to take this? You want to take this globally at one point in time and start in Atlanta and continue to expand it?
I want to start in Atlanta and take it as big as I can take it. That's the plan.
And learning from others, are there any other former players that have foundations that have been able to help you out and help you in the process of growing yours?
I partner with a couple of my former teammates, the Mike Peterson Foundation and the Drayton Florence Foundation. And we always support each other and help each other out during our foundations and stuff like that.
So you're able to show up to those events and be a part of it, and then they show up to your events, and it's a great back-and-forth type of situation. And one thing I've talked to many people, the key thing is that if you stay in your community and you really kind of give back to that community, even after you retire, that it really is such an important thing. So you take what your success was on the football field and then know that it's for life. It's not just for the time you played on the field. You can change people's lives forever based on that gift that you were given.
Definitely. And I want to just try to continue to use it and do other things to help people and just continue to be a force in the community, even though I'm not playing football anymore.
And the force in the community. And how is it now, I guess, in a specific way of being able to be the voice? Is it is it different or challenging in a way to be able to go out and, because again, you spoke on the football field, you took care of people on the football field, you were a superstar on the football field. Now you have to use your voice. Is that a challenge in certain ways, or is it something that you really relish, like this opportunity now to use your voice compared to before where you're doing an action on the football field?
It's definitely a transition for me. I like to be able to use my voice and be able to use my knowledge and be able to go in situations where you know things about it and be able to talk intelligently about it. Because, you know, being a former football player, a lot of people expect for you to come in situations not knowing what you're talking about and things of that sort. So it gives me a chance to kill a stereotype and present myself in a different light to a bunch of people who never saw me pass the football field.
Well, Marcus, I wish you all the luck in the world. I want the website again, and also any place we can follow you and learn more about you as well, not just your foundation. If you have a Twitter or a Facebook for our listeners out.
If you want to follow me, you can follow me at Twitter at MarcusStroud99 to find out more about my foundation. It's the Marcus Stroud Charitable Foundation.org.
And then they can find specific particulars about you and different things about the foundation if they want to contact you or use you as a spokesperson to help, definitely help in the obesity fight. So I appreciate you calling, Marcus, and maybe bring you back in 3 to 4 months to find out how everything went with the fundraiser and stay in touch. So thanks again for calling, Marcus.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. All right, that was Marcus Stroud. You're listening to the Total Education Celebrity Show, Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Tutor Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment. And I'm really excited to say hello back to my great co-host, G.J. Reynolds. G.J., how are you?
Doing great. Thanks a lot, Neil. Another great show and another great interview.
All right, so go ahead and introduce our guest. I'm excited because I'm a huge Washington Redskins fan from that era, because I remember when they were out near Harrisburg in their training camp and stuff, and I got autographs with Theismann and all of them, so I'm really excited to introduce our guest. Go ahead.
Our next guest played with Mr. Joe Theismann. He played at UCLA. And then ended up going into the pros, played for Cincinnati and the Redskins, and he was on the 1982 World Champion, Super Bowl champion. So he's a former Super Bowl champion. And he's also now a broadcaster, turned media personality. He's a public speaker, and he's a leader in the community. And please welcome to the show, Rick Doc Walker. How you doing, Doc?
Hey, Tom, how you guys doing, man? Well, we got unseasonably warm day in the nation capital, around 34 degrees. So whenever there's no precipitation, I got a smile on my face.
Well, I as well, but I guess GJ's in LA, so he's enjoying great weather while we're enjoying, like you said, very chilly, but better than 2 degrees or whatever. So I think that's key. So basically, for our audience, GJ did a fantastic job announcing. Specifically, tell us basically a little bit about, I guess, life after football with you, Doc. Basically, right when your career ended, basically, you had a lot of other opportunities. But again, it's difficult for football players after their career is over, correct, to kind of find their niche.
Well, it's difficult for college graduates and our major universities to kind of find their niche. It's not just athletes. I think it's people in all walks of life. It's a very difficult transition from high school to college to your profession, and changing jobs. I just never grew up with the illusion that football was permanent. The only good thing about being in the 70s was that nobody was making money and people had jobs in the off season. And so I figured that since this was not a means that you could get rich at, it would be foolish not to have your finger or hand in several options if you wanted to maintain a particular lifestyle. The downside to being from L.A. and going to UCLA was that you got a chance to see wealth and to see people doing very well. I didn't know that we were poor growing up, because everybody was about the same, and we never missed food. We had whatever I needed to play the athletics. And so my mother did a phenomenal job of creating an environment for me that made us. So I thought it was normal. When I went to college, I realized that we were below the borderline poverty level, and yet we didn't need anything. And then I watched the rich people of Beverly Hills and Hollywood, and I saw a particular lifestyle that is looks like Fantasy Island, unless you live there, or I guess suppose New York has the same atmosphere. And so then you realize that to get on any particular level financially, you got to be smart.
That definitely, that's so key. So I guess GJ, what you're seeing is again, we've heard this before with Andy Russell and many of players that played in his time or a little bit before his time, that the money wasn't there in the NFL. It sounds like.
Right. Well, you know, obviously, you know, we talked about Tocilo Brown and the kind of money he made coaching would now be poverty level money. And the players that grew up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, that was what they set the tone for the big money to come and the big business to come. And, you know, so obviously it was definitely a tough time. They had to be creative and, you know, create a work ethic outside of football. And obviously Doc's done that. So what were some of the challenges that you were faced initially before you found your groove right after football, Doc?
Well, I didn't find it after football. I was working while I played. And, again, that's the benefit of guys like Larry Brown, who, when I got to this town, was involved. He was a businessman. Charlie Taylor was in the scouting department. Bobby Mitchell was assistant general manager. I watched these guys. They had Greg Owens was a lawyer, and Joe Theismann had a restaurant. Mark Mosley had a travel agency. I watched guys that had jobs, they had businesses, so I knew then that I was able to exercise an entrepreneurial spirit, and also I knew what I really wanted to do, so I figured if I got to start interning somewhere, I was able to be fortunate enough to get great mentorship from two of the top guys in the entire market, Glenn Brenner at Channel 9, George Michael at Channel 4. George hired me. I started in 1983. I retired in 85. So I'd already been working. I'd already was in business. So I never, ever thought that this was going to be it. It was not a means to an end. I just wanted to be a champion. My goal playing ball was to be a champion. And then exit, you know, and then start the longer process of being a champion in life, which is far more difficult to claim in pro sports.
That's so true. And I guess, and that's where I guess I think that, Doc, you should tell specific people that are playing in the NFL now to have that thought process. Even though they're making tons of money, they're living that lifestyle. They slowly but surely could be done and have no money at all. So I guess that's such an important thing. I'm sure being involved in with the college sports and also as an announcer and also a sideline reporter for the Redskins, you kind of tell these guys, you better have a backup plan, right?
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. The new school athlete, for the most part, not all, the Lorenzo Alexanders, the antithesis of this, who is a gladiator on and off the field, they have great passion. Kendrick Golston, Reed Dowdy. I can name a lot of guys who get it. I think Robert Griffin III is showing me, Alfred Morris. But they're showing me, even as young guys with a lot of recognition, that you still have a focus on the offseason, entrepreneurial spirit, the way Robert is leveraging Subway and Adidas. I credit him for that. This is about developing skills and increasing your value. Most athletes are only, the sum total of their existence is based on their athletic performance.
Right.
They see themselves as whatever they perform by. I watched the retired guy. People come and say sign, and they sign a number. People will ask me, well, put your number down. I politely tell them, I don't have a number. You know, my number is, Pierre Garçon is wearing a number that I used to wear. And that's the enslavement that comes down by these guys who become so enthralled in, hey, I'm a player. Well, yeah, that's true. I'm a part-time player. I mean, they're paying you part-time money, but these guys consider it to be full-time because they have no idea of the real world.
Right.
And they just don't have a... And I'm not mad, you know, but I understand that if they're too dumb to look at the statistics of failure in their own sport, who am I to tell them? It's not what I do for a living. My thrust is based on, you know, corporate presentation. And that's why, because I don't have the patience to deal with young people. Now, I don't mean young. I love 6th and 7th and 8th graders. But that middle, the high school, the collegiate, they think because I'm working two jobs and I'm working day and night, they perceive that as a failure because they don't get it. And that's their parents' job, not mine. I got my own kids to deal with. And I just think that the society has built this system.